Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think the things that I've decided to do and the steps I've put in place, I'm going to maintain them for a while because you just never know when an outbreak can occur.
Jana Wilson talking about the outbreak of avian influenza in Indiana. Even though the virus has been successfully contained, she says it's permanently changed how she raises her backyard chickens. It's a day of tacos in the kitchen. One recipe is vegan, the other uses fish. From harvest, we meet a new breed of pig. Could genetically engineered animals move from the lab to our plates anytime soon? Then a small town in Nebraska didn't have a grocery store until local students stepped up. First, news with Mark Chilla.
Supporters of labeling for foods with genetically modified ingredients in Maine are pushing for a revised state law that would not depend on passage of laws in nearby Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Connecticut. Maine already passed a law a year ago that will require labels if the four other states pass similar measures. The trigger was meant to ensure local grocery stores wouldn't have to shoulder all the cost of making the labels. With more states adopting the measure at the same time, manufacturers would more likely chip in to accommodate grocers. But some lawmakers want to sever those contingencies and let the state's law stand on its own. Maine's current law would also be repealed automatically if a total of five states fail to pass such laws by 2018. The proposed amendment would also remove this sunset clause. GE salmon, also known as frankenfish by opponents, will not be found on U.S. supermarket shelves in the near future. The FDA issued an alert last week saying that the agency must work out label guidelines before it will allow the fish or any product made from it to be imported. The salmon, developed by the biotech company Aqua Bounty Technologies, has genes that allow it to grow faster and withstand cold temperatures. The temporary ban stems from a budget bill Congress signed into law in December. It could take years for the FDA to finalize its label rules on the GE salmon and clear the way for imports. The company's innovation marks the first time a genetically modified animal has been sold for human consumption. American food company OSI Group LLC has challenged a decision of a Chinese court that said the company sold out-of-date meat to companies including McDonald's and Yum Brands. In 2014, a television report showed chicken nuggets being made from expired meat in Shanghai. The incident resulted in prison sentences for 10 people and total fines of $365,000. OSI said in a statement that the verdict is, quote, inconsistent with facts and evidence presented in the court, and that the company's employees were unfairly detained for 17 months. The Wall Street Journal reports that internal OSI documents show that a disgruntled employee and two journalists staged the television report. The company has been one of the biggest suppliers in China before the scandal, but McDonald's, Yum Brands, and Burger King cut ties with the company soon after the story aired. And remember when Hellmann's sued vegan mayo brand Just Mayo? Well, now they've changed their tune. Unilever, parent company of the mayo giant Hellmann's, has announced they would create their own egg-free version of mayonnaise, but they won't be calling it as such. Hellmann's so-called carefully crafted dressing and sandwich spread sidesteps the name mayo, a term they took issue with when Hampton Creek tried 2 years ago to market Just Mayo. Hellmann's eventually dropped the lawsuit, stating Just Mayo could take the issue to industry groups. So why the change of heart and recipe? Well, Unilever argues it's only giving its customers what they want – choice. For their part, Hampton Creek welcomes the competition, stating it would, quote, help create a bigger market for plant-based alternatives, unquote. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie post these articles at eartheats.org, and Twitter is the place where we post stories like these, so visit us there to stay up to date on food and farming news.
Find us at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla with the headlines. Great work.
Thanks, Annie.
Humans have been breeding animals for millennia. Now there's a modern development. Genetically engineered animals could be coming soon to your dinner plate. As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, regulators are currently grappling with this new technology.
Tucked away in a University of Missouri research building is a family of pigs. Two new litters joined the family 4 days ago. Melissa Samuel takes care of the whole group. They range from 4 days old to about a year and a half. They're pudgy and pink.
I think they're pretty happy pigs, though. They're pretty easy to work with. They do what we want them to do. They seem happy, like their back scratched every now and then.
The goal is to have farmers raise pigs like these for your ham hocks and pork butts. But they're not raised in hog barns just yet. That's because these little piggies are special.
These pigs have been modified so that they are resistant to the PRRS, the porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome virus.
These are genetically engineered pigs. The porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome virus, or PRRS, first popped up in the 1980s. Kristen Whitworth is a research scientist at the University of Missouri who helped develop these virus-resistant pigs. She says the virus costs the U.S. pork industry more than $660 million a year.
It's a devastating disease. It causes persistent infection. It causes abortions in pigs, so they'll lose their litters. It causes a lot of coughing, and the pigs get very sick.
Once the virus enters a pig, it spreads with the help of a protein. Whitworth and her team genetically edited the gene that makes this protein, effectively removing it.
And once that molecule is no longer present, then the virus cannot only get inside the macrophages, but cannot spread from pig to pig.
This is big news for livestock producers. If a pig is infected, a farmer typically has to euthanize the whole barn, Whitworth says. It's financially and emotionally devastating. Researchers from the University of Missouri and Kansas State University developed the PRRS-resistant pig with funding from their universities and the company that ultimately owns the rights to the research. They announced their findings in December. Whitworth says they hope to have the pigs to market in 5 years.
Yeah, and maybe we're being optimistic. But
well, scientists tend to be optimistic, right? I mean, that's you're in science to try to solve problems.
Allison Van Inenum is an animal biotechnology and genomics specialist at the University of California, Davis. She says it's challenging to get animals that have been genetically modified approved by the Food and Drug Administration. There is just one approved animal out there, a salmon that has been genetically modified to grow twice as fast as wild salmon.
Up until this point, even though the technology was developed, you know, more than 30 years ago, that's the only thing that's ever got through regulatory, and it took about 20 years and tens of millions of dollars to get it through.
The FDA won't allow sales of the fish stateside until it finishes its labeling guidelines, a process which could take additional years. There are other genetically engineered animals in the works. Hornless cattle, hypoallergenic cows, pigs resistant to African swine fever. So why aren't more genetically engineered animals in stores? Two big reasons. One, Van Inenum says that the technology is still relatively new, so the FDA has a lot of questions.
The animal breeding community is kind of looking to see, well, what is going to be the response of regulators to this technology?
And two, there is no one-size-fits-all study. Each animal and genetic modification is different. Kevin Wells is an assistant professor at the University of Missouri who worked with the PRRS-resistant pigs and sat on the Federal Advisory Committee on the Super Salmon.
For example, if you're introducing a brand new protein that perhaps humans don't typically eat, is that something that we're allergic to? Whereas you wouldn't have to necessarily ask that question of something that we eat every day.
Then there are worries about consumer response. The FDA also needs to sort out if and how the products derived from genetically engineered animals will be labeled. When it comes to the PRRS-resistant pigs, researcher Kristen Whitworth says Genus, the company that purchased the technology, will do the hoop jumping for federal approval.
They will look at feed efficiency and growth, and they'll introduce the edit into their genetic lines.
If that happens, it won't be long before they're in grocery stores across the country. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Later today, we go inside a student-run grocery store in the tiny town of Cody. The latest news this week on the avian influenza outbreak in DuBois County, Indiana. No additional birds have tested positive for the H7N8 strain of the deadly virus. The outbreak was first reported on January 15th.
and the responses from both state and USDA officials was almost immediate. Within days, some 400,000 turkeys and chickens were euthanized on 10 different commercial farms. Officials are still trying to determine how the virus wound up on Indiana poultry farms. It's possible wild birds carrying the virus are to blame, as was the case in the avian influenza outbreak from June 2015. So that's our background. I'm here with Jana Wilson to talk about what an outbreak like this means for small backyard chicken farmers. Jana raises about 35 birds on her property in rural Monroe County. So glad to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
When you heard the news, what was your first reaction?
Oh, no, here we go again, was my first reaction. And my second reaction was, phew, my birds have been inside for 3 weeks now due to a hungry hawk that I had just kept them inside. And I thought, well, isn't that good they've been inside? Because as you mentioned, sometimes avian influenza can be transmitted by wild birds. And so, yeah, we're deciding right now what we're going to do in the future in terms of allowing them to be outside, which, of course, we want them to be, but not having wild birds access, getting access to their pen.
Right. So. You're active on Facebook groups and other chats with backyard farmers. Mm-hmm. How were other people reacting?
Well, I was really surprised because after about a week or so, I thought, well, surely someone's going to say something about it. And I went on my Facebook groups and I went on my chat boards and no one mentioned it. And I went actually asked the question to the Facebook, couple of Facebook groups, why is no, you know, is anybody concerned about this? And most people said, no, not really. It happened on a commercial property and I just figured it didn't affect me. And I was a little surprised, not because I think any of us need to be panicking. I'm certainly not panicking, but I'm cautious and I definitely have been thinking about it.
And it's especially important for a farm like yours. You raise two breeds of chickens, both of which on the livestock conservancy's lists. Your Anconas are on the watch list and your Buttercups are listed as threatened.
Right.
So you really want to protect these birds.
You know, I've often said that I have to be very careful because if my flocks were wiped out from avian influenza or if a few of them were found to have avian influenza, they would have to obviously kill the entire flock. That could certainly wipe out, especially for the Buttercups, it could wipe out the breed for generations to come if they ever return because so few people breed them. So I'm very conscious of the fact that I have to be careful because I have, you know, a treasure and a very rare treasure in this breed that's just – there aren't very many of them.
And so. Quite the responsibility.
It is a big responsibility. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we talked about the hawk who is wreaking havoc on your flock. And so you put your birds in the coop.
Yeah.
What other precautions have you taken because of the avian flu outbreak?
I've always been very careful about letting people come on my property, especially other people with chickens because, you know, if there's some kind of a disease on their farm, they don't know about it. I've just stopped all visitation. And, you know, I've always been really careful about the clothes and the shoes I wear. I have a special pair of boots that I only wear out in my pen and in my barns. And I've done that for a while. So, as I said, I'm just taking a few minor extra precautions and this is all just common sense stuff because avian influenza is certainly not the only disease that birds can get.
The Indiana State Board of Animal Health is now requiring all bird owners, including backyard chicken farmers, to maintain records of flock additions and removals for 3 years. And this rule was put in place in 2015 after the last outbreak. So talk about what that process is like for you.
You know, it's truly not complicated. It's just there's a template, a form. And in fact, at some of the shows last fall, the Indiana Board of Animal Health people were actually at shows with a table giving us pamphlets, talking to people about what they needed to do.
So because you take your birds to poultry shows to show them.
The few that were run last year toward the end of the year, many of them were shut down earlier in the year. But yeah, so I just have a book and I keep a form in there and the few birds that I actually, you know, have sold this year, I just keep records. Okay, so now they've added an addendum to this requirement and it says that all buyers of birds from out of state have to either have a certificate of veterinary inspection or National Poultry Improvement Plan form. And people who are buying chicks from a hatchery, for example, probably should ask that question of their hatchery, you know, ask.
Well, you do that. You're hatching birds right now and selling them to whoever wants them.
I do. I have sold birds to people in California and Texas and Missouri and, you know.
And you're going to get that certification? You're thinking about it?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have decided to start that process. And it's a pretty hefty process. I mean, you have to have your birds tested for 5 different diseases. You know, in my case, because I sell exhibition poultry, I think it's just going to be something that we're going to have to do. And people who just have, you know, chickens in their backyard, well, you need to be aware of it too.
It seems as though we're past the worst of it. No new outbreaks. Are you feeling like now you can switch gears and sort of get back to normal on your farm?
No. No. I think the things that I've decided to do and the steps I've put in place, I'm going to maintain them for a while because you just never know when an outbreak can occur. Mm-hmm. And I will be looking at making some kind of a new structure, maybe more of an aviary structure over my very large pen, which is really half of my backyard. So we'll be looking at ways of perhaps – getting better about keeping wild animals out.
So like a more elaborate coop?
Well, my coop is pretty elaborate right now. I have a pretty large coop. It's about 15 by 30. We have a lovely picture window, and it was really nice. But probably what I will be doing is maybe adding some structure or framing outside of it with netting of some kind. So we're going to look at that.
Listeners have to go check out Jana's beautiful birds. They are stunningly beautiful. We've got photos on the website, so that's eartheats.org. Jana Wilson is our resident chicken expert. So glad to have you share your information today.
I'm glad to do it.
Coming up.
Your toaster's your friend. Don't forget it. It's not just for breakfast anymore. Good for taco night.
Daniel Orr has a trick for crisping up tortillas. 2 recipes that would be good for Super Bowl Sunday, Meatless Monday, or Taco Tuesday. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Okay. Let me make sure I got...
He's Chef Bob Adkins.
Okay. Today we're going to do a little spin on tacos, and we're going to make raw, vegan Napa tacos. Okay? What I have here are some nice walnuts. Toss the raw nuts into the bowl of the food processor. Into that, we're going to add a little powdered garlic, maybe 2 tablespoons of really nice fresh chili powder that hasn't been sitting in the back of your cabinet for 2 years. You know who you are, spice people. We're going to put about maybe 2 teaspoons of freshly ground cumin, a nice little pinch of salt, nice little pinch of pepper. You could put some cayenne in here if you'd like it to be a little spicy, but these will keep a little mild, and then some extra virgin olive oil. We're just going to pulse the walnuts and the spices together. You don't want to really make a paste. You know, taco meat is crumbly, but it's small. So we're just going to... And you're going to be surprised how much like a meat taco this does taste. Since we're not going to use anything that's cooked, instead of using a tortilla that's been fried or pressed, we're going to use, once again, some handy-dandy Napa cabbage leaves. sprinkle the nut meat inside the napa leaves. And then I like to top it with some freshly made pico de gallo. So once you have that, you can put some whole cilantro on there. You could put some jalapenos. The bottom line is they are very easy. And I think you'd have a hard time telling the difference between that and a regular meat taco.
He's right. It was like a magic trick. Why walnuts and not a different nut? Chef Bob says walnuts have a good neutral flavor and a good texture, especially when paired with some olive oil. Also, it won't break the bank. Another taco recipe after this. It's hard for grocery stores to survive in small rural communities. But a unique store in a tiny town in north central Nebraska is nearing its third year of operation because of who owns and operates it. For Harvest Public Media, Mike Tobias travels to Cody, home of the Circle C Market.
Thursdays, staff at the Circle C Market check what's in stock and decide what's to order. Erin Cheney is produce coordinator.
I'm looking to see what we have a lot of, what we don't have very much of. So I'm ordering more celery because we only have four packages.
Can I have the meat department, please?
In a cramped backroom office, Brittany Doherty calls the grocery store's food supplier.
This is Circle C Market, and we were wondering about ordering family-sized turkeys.
While Sydney Adamson works on a computer.
I'm entering all the daily work in QuickBooks.
The handful of Circle C staffers finish their hour of work and go back to school. Yes, back to Cody Kilgore School, a couple blocks away, where Adamson and the others are students.
Student-run grocery store, that's not very common.
Rare, in fact, although nationally there are a couple other school-run nonprofit grocery stores like Circle C. How did this happen in Cody? First, a little background. The village sits atop Cherry County, a sparsely populated chunk of Sandhills Ranch land bigger than the entire state of Connecticut. Just 156 people call Cody home, not a prime location for any retail business. Cody's previous grocery store closed more than a decade ago.
It started through a brainstorming session actually here at the school long before I was here.
Says Todd Chesmore, who was attracted to the Cody Kilgore School superintendent job because of the Circle C project.
And a couple teachers said, kind of as a joke, we need to have a grocery store. Well, as the discussion went on, that joke turned into, let's see what we can do.
They turned a crazy idea into reality, involving students and community members from the beginning. The USDA and other groups helped with startup funds and planning. After a few years of discussion and debate, they were ready to break ground. Then it took a few months and lots of volunteers to construct the unique 3,500-square-foot building, which has walls filled with straw for insulation. The Circle C finally opened for business about 2.5 years ago. Here's how it works. A board of community members oversees the nonprofit operation. Chesmore is executive director. During the school day, students take on tasks at the store as part of different classes, with a paid adult employee and teachers on hand to help train and supervise. The rest of the time, students are paid to work at Circle C.
The store is truly run by students. We have adults that are involved, but essentially we try and get the kids to do pretty much everything.
Jess Moore says, and that's everything from elementary school students decorating grocery bags to high schoolers deciding to stock a new cereal.
So we could also do one to replace the crisp rice because I don't think anyone's going to buy that.
No, it never sells. Yeah,
we have rows and rows of that.
Adamson, a sophomore, schedules workers and has been known to cover an open shift at the last minute. Not easy when you live 45 miles from town.
Most people wouldn't think it'd work, and the students are doing most of the work. We have supervisors, but it's on us. And so it's just, there's a lot of mistakes made, but everything is fixable, and we're getting through it, and it's growing and doing well.
The store did about $250,000 of business last year. Chesmore says the operation is self-sustaining and in the black, but not by much, and primarily because of how it's run.
Without the school being as intimately involved as it is, I don't think it could be done. It cannot generate enough funds and still be competitive to stay open.
What doesn't show up on the Circle C ledger is how the village and its people benefit from having a local grocery store that's not an hour round trip away. But there are jobs, but there are also the jobs and experiences for students.
One of my favorite classes.
says 8th grader Lizzie Hooper.
If I ever want to learn a business, I know what to put on the shelves, how to put it on the shelves, how to finance, how to get grants, and marketing and advertising.
Adamson, who will manage the store this summer, says Circle C helps her prepare for a possible future in accounting. But she's learned more by being involved in the process from the start.
And the store has really taught me to, never take the first no. Like, there's always a solution. And people will tell you no, and you just got to keep working and don't give up.
An attitude reflected throughout a tiny town that calls itself Too Tough to Die. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Mike Tobias.
There are photos and a video that go with this story. Find them at harvestpublicmedia.org.
So, continuing our taco day here at Farm Bloomington.
For this one, it's Chef Daniel Orr. He and Bob Atkins were tag-teaming these taco recipes in the kitchen at Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Daniel has some tortillas for us this time, but a trick to crisp them up.
So what you do is you fold your taco, and you put it in your toaster, and let it run its course, and you're going to have a nice crispy taco, perfectly formed, without having to fry it, defat fry it. Your toaster is your friend. Don't forget it. It's not just for breakfast anymore. Good for taco night.
Okay, so we got the taco shell. Okay, and what are we going to put in it?
Okay. What we're going to put in it is tilapia today. Now, I've put it in a Ziploc bag, marinated it with some capers, some scallions, a little bit of tomato, and some chili powder. Okay, and I've laid a layer of limes down on my little tray, and I'm going to broil this. So usually fish tacos are deep fried. So again, we're staying with this kind of healthy version. Okay, and when you put it on those limes, it's going to help you get it up off the tray without it sticking. I'm going to sprinkle this a little salt and pepper under the broiler, probably for about 4 to 5 minutes until it's cooked through. This I would make sure that it's really cooked through. With a taco, you don't really want to be fighting a raw piece of fish in there. So this you want it to be a little bit flaky, so go ahead and cook it all the way through. Okay, here's our tilapia.
Piping hot, fresh from the broiler.
All right, we're going to put a piece of that in the taco. Okay, we're going to add a little bit of our pico de gallo. And another good thing to do is like some shredded cabbage, put some shredded carrots in here. And of course you have to have some cilantro, and those are our fish tacos.
Great. Recipes for these at eartheats.org, and do a search for our pralines recipe to celebrate Mardi Gras. Our kitchen crew is Bob Atkins and Daniel Orr. On the website, it's Aabon Binder and Betsy Shepherd. And thanks to our writers, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Liz Leslie. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Oh, and one more thing. Hear Earth Eats on demand by subscribing to the podcast. Just search for Earth Eats. All right. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.